Shalom and welcome to Israel Inspired on Voice of Israel, voiceofisrael.com. We are here live from Jerusalem on Elections Day, and we have with us in studio Dan Diker. His reputation precedes him, and it's really a privilege to have him with us. I've been listening to his programming, and you are a consummate professional, Dan. Thank you so much for joining us.
How much is this going to cost me?
It ain't costing you anything, but joining me on my interview that I'm about to have with a man that I met a number of years ago, and this guy, talk about being on the front lines in the war of ideas, Daniel Pipes. He's a historian, a writer, political commentator, president of the Middle East Forum, Middle East Quarterly Journal, the publisher, and we have him on the show with us. Daniel Pipes, are you with us?
I am with you.
Thank you so much for joining us. We were just discussing you this morning, and Dan Diker, who's with me in studio, was telling me about your familial lineage, about your father, Dan.
Well, besides the fact that Daniel Pipes is one of the great scholars of the Middle East we have in our generation, his dad, Professor Richard Pipes, was a professor of mine at Harvard, and so the association with the Pipes legacy is a great one. So nice to hear your voice, Daniel.
And you too, Dan.
So let me ask: we're here on Election Day. Who do you think would be the best person for Israel to elect as our prime minister? From the outside, from an American perspective. I'm asking you, and I know that you just wrote Americans Battle the Arab-Israeli Conflict, and your entire premise of this was that foreign nations should really stay out, because on both sides they're more vitriolic, they're more zealous and passionate than internally in the conflict here, which is something I'd like to discuss with you later. But from your side, from America, who do you think would be the best prime minister for us to have here in Israel?
Oh, I have no doubt of that. It would be a continuation of the Netanyahu government. I shudder to think what Mr. Herzog's government would look like and what its effect would be.
Well, do you think that Herzog being elected would be a positive thing for the American-Israeli relationship, which has seen better times, to put it mildly?
It might well be, but I actually have a counterintuitive take on that. I'm quite pleased when there's a certain level of tensions in the U.S.-Israel relationship, because when there's not, as for example there was not between Bill Clinton and Yitzhak Rabin, then the Israeli side is prone to make all sorts of concessions and give all sorts of gifts that it shouldn't give. Another example would be during the George W. Bush years, when Israelis, for example, gave the Philadelphia corridor over to the Egyptians and Palestinians to control. So when there is a certain level of tension, then the Israelis don't make these foolhardy gifts, and I think that's a good thing. I don't want to go too far, but a certain level of abrasiveness and tension, you know, the president leaving the prime minister to cool his heels and, well, he goes to dinner, that's just fine with me.
Dr. Pipes, I think there's an elephant in the room here that many in the United States are not seeing, and that is that on the Palestinian file, which has been really the flagship one of the flagships of the Obama administration's thinking and acting on the Middle East, a Bougie Herzog government would not be particularly different than the Netanyahu approach to the Palestinian issue, and I think that there's a real disconnect there in the United States. Herzog has already said that Jerusalem, you know, United Jerusalem is important for Israel, and that's obviously a non-starter with the Palestinians. He's not in favor of returning to 67 lines. So I don't really see a lot of daylight between his actual policy approach on the ground and the Netanyahu's, and I just don't see how I see the Americans expecting something very, very different if it were to be a Herzog-led government.
Again, if you take the history of Israeli electioneering and Israeli governance, you see that time and again over the past 20-some years, the Israeli candidates have said something much tougher during the election season than has been the case during their governance. For example, Rabin said he would never, in his latter tenure, that he would never give up any parts of Israel, of Jerusalem, to the Palestinians. Netanyahu said he would never give up any part of the Golan Heights. Sharon most spectacularly said he would never leave unilaterally the Gaza Strip. And in all cases and others, they did precisely that. So I don't really believe Herzog at all. I think it would be a big surprise to me if he actually kept to this tough line that he's now offering.
Well, here you have. How do you? What is your take on the current tensions, as you would have defined it, between the United States and Israel? I mean, there are many here that consider them to be more than just tensions, but to be some sort of a low intensity crisis between the administration and the Netanyahu and the Netanyahu coalition, and we haven't seen before a prime minister come to the United States, speak in front of Congress in complete contravention of the policy of the sitting president of the United States. And this type of tension seems to be ratcheted up to unprecedented levels. Yes or no? I mean, in your view, does this sort of fit along the continuum of past crises, whether it was President Ford and Yitzhak Rabin in 75 over the Egyptian policy towards the Egyptians, or whether it was Iraq and Osirak during the Reagan administrations? How does this mini crisis fit in your view?
Well, from given the context you just gave, it's not that different. It certainly could spiral out of control. But I think what makes it really different is not so much the nature of U.S.-Israel tensions, but the fact that the U.S. government under Barack Obama, especially the last 2 years, has taken a very different approach than other governments have, much to the dismay of others in the Middle East. Israel is not unique. If you look at the Saudis as a paramount example, but also the Egyptians and to a certain extent the Jordanians, as well as all the other Gulf Arab states, you see a dismay with Washington. So, and you can look further and see other tensions as well. So Israel fits into a much larger regional context now. As the U.S. government under Barack Obama reaches out to the Iranians, there are many governments in the Middle East that are dismayed and are having real tensions. So it's different in that sense. This is never, Israel's never been part of a gang before, and it is today.
So I just got an email from a good friend, South Carolina Congressman Robert Pittenger, and he's signed on to this letter that's urging Obama and the State Department to come clean regarding questionable funding of anti-Netanyahu campaign. Do you think that it's gone that far that the president and the administration is really funding and going out of their way to meddle in these elections to make sure Netanyahu is unseated?
I would not be at all surprised. I've dubbed the U.S.-Israel relationship the family relationship of international politics. And part of that family relationship is that each side intervenes in the other's domestic political affairs. Benjamin Netanyahu certainly made clear who he preferred when Romney and Obama were slugging it out 3 years ago, and so forth. Back through the decades, on both sides this has happened. Now, actually providing money for a candidate in the Israeli elections, that's going further than usual. But having a role, making it clear who you prefer, working with one side implicitly against the other side, that's pretty much standard fare.
So it wouldn't surprise you if indeed he was being funded. It really feels from this side of the ocean that that there's never been so much daylight between the U.S. and Israel. But my question is, do you feel like it transcends merely the administration and it's gone down to the people themselves, the American population? It's hard to imagine that it wouldn't carry over if Obama's a relatively popular president and he so cannot tolerate the thought of Netanyahu that the people that support him wouldn't also adopt some sort of element of that.
Let me phrase it differently than you have. Israel, as a country, is extremely popular in the United States. It's something like 4, 5, or even 6 times more popular than its opponents, particularly the Palestinians. So Israel's in very good standing. When it comes to specific policies, however, you see a distinction that is growing and growing between the right and the left. The right is ever more pro-Israel, and especially the conservative Republicans. And the left, and especially the liberal Democrats, is increasingly cool, dubious, with independence somewhere in between. So a spectrum has emerged. And what this implies is that administrations, or for that matter, Congresses, that are Republican, it'll be all the warmer. And for administrations and Congresses that are Democratic, it will be all the cooler. This is not to Israel's benefit. It has been much better served by a bipartisan spirit. But for whatever reason, that bipartisan spirit is dying, and Israel's becoming more a conservative cause than a liberal cause.
Well, that's exactly an issue that concerns us here, is the spirit of bipartisanism since the founding of the state has been really... has been a biblical watchword for coalitions from the left and from the right. And here we see, for the first time, a type of divisiveness over Israel, a cooling off, a dubiousness, as you put it, Dr. Pipes. Is this due in how much is this due to the Obama White House's approach to Israel, or versus other types of demographic developments in the United States?
I would see the Obama administration as a symptom of this rather than a cause. If you take the larger picture, and this is fairly complex, but to simplify, from the creation of the State of Israel until about 1970, Democrats were friendlier to Israel than Republicans. Democrats looked to Israel as a fellow democracy, Holocaust survivors, were emotional. Republicans tend to see it in terms of being an obstacle vis-a-vis the Soviet Union. There was then a period of about 20 years, from 1970 to 1990, when both sides were equally pro-Israel. Since 1990, and with increasing speed in recent years, one sees the division that I talked about before of Democrats becoming cooler. And Obama fits into that. He's not the cause of it. He's just part of it. And it looks like it's going to continue. It looks like it's getting sharper. Polls increasingly show a divergence between Republicans and Democrats.
Where are we going? Let's just take a larger view. I mean, one of the great benefits of those who follow the Middle East Forum and follow your work, Dr. Pipes, is your larger view on the Middle East. It seems clear that that President Obama is going for a grand bargain with the Islamic Republic of Iran. What will American foreign policy look like going forward, whether or not this succeeds? It looks like this is a watershed moment just in the outreach to the Islamic Republic, regardless if a deal is actually signed. What are the implications of this diplomacy right now for American foreign policy, especially in the Middle East?
Well, it appears that the grand goal of Obama's foreign policy is to bring Iran in from the cold, to end the hostility, to make Iran be a normal, responsible country with whom we have decent relations. That seems to be his overarching goal, his most important goal in foreign policy. It's not a bad idea in and of itself, but it is a terrible idea when one looks at the consequences, when one looks at the complete rejection of the premises of this idea on the Iranian side. So it goes on and on despite all the failures it has led to so far, and there's every reason to think it will continue into the future with yet greater failures. This has many implications for American policy in the Middle East. As I mentioned earlier, the Saudis, Egyptians, and others are very worried, are talking about building nuclear weapons, are talking about an Arab military force, are having this sense that they must fend for themselves because the U.S. government is not there to support them and bind them and provide a security umbrella for them.
Does this bode for a new architecture? Sorry, I just wanted to follow up. Does this suggest a new possible regional architecture for the Middle East in which Israel plays a much stronger role in the sense that the Sunni Arab establishment now is very much rooting for Israel quietly, depending on Israel, hoping that Israel will attack Iran? They gave us three thumbs up or two thumbs up on Netanyahu's congressional speech before Congress as being the only Middle Eastern country that would actually stand up to the United States. How are you seeing a real opportunity for Israel in a new architecture in view of the American sort of collapse on the Middle East?
No, I don't. I see it as a temporary concession. Okay, Iran is our main problem today. Israel has the right policies. We're grateful for this. We hope Israel does the right things. But one day when Tehran no longer poses the kind of challenges and threats that it does today, I think things will revert back to the usual anti-Zionist spirit. In other words, I don't see this as a turning point. I see it as a momentary change from the usual. I would not invest much into this emotionally and say, okay, the Saudis, Egyptians, and others have come to terms with Israel and accepted. I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. We're here with Daniel Pipes, president of the Middle East Forum, publisher of Middle East Quarterly. Daniel, please stay with us. We have a 30-second station ID break, and I just have a couple more questions I have to ask you. Listeners,
sure,
do not touch
sure.
the dial. You're going to want to hear this.
Could you prevent a nuclear Iran better than Netanyahu?
Yes.
This is Gil Hoffman of Inside Israel Today on Voice of Israel, and I had the privilege of interviewing both Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Likud and Tzipi Livni of the Zionist Union just ahead of the election.
I refuse to divide Jerusalem. I refuse to go back to the 67 lines. I demand that the Palestinians give up the right of return.
Listen to what they had to say and compare. That's exclusive interviews on Voice of Israel.
We are back with Daniel Pipes. Now, Daniel, I want to ask you a little bit of a, you know, from an aerial view. I want your perception of how America in general or foreign countries should be dealing with the Israeli conflict. Because you wrote this article, I believe you titled Americans Battle the Arab-Israeli Conflict. And your premise was that on both sides, the haters are more hateful, more vitriolic, the extremists are more zealous than even on the ground here. In Israel, and this tends to apply with conflicts around the world. Number one, why do you think that this is the case?
I think it's the case because if you're actually engaged in a conflict, you understand the subtleties, you have to deal with the opponent, especially in the Israeli-Palestinian context. There's a lot of contacts between the two sides. Whereas if you're living in the United States or far away, it's just black and white. There's no gray. In the actual place, there's a lot of gray, a lot of subtlety and complexity.
So on a practical level, how should that be applied? Should there be more of a libertarian approach, hands off in general, and just let the sides deal? You know, there's an entire school of thought here that the Arab-Israeli conflict is really what it is because the British intervened and got the flames going between the Arabs and Jews. I don't know if I personally believe in that, how should this be practically applied?
I think what it implies is that outsiders who generally have a sense of moral superiority don't really have that. It's not valid. The outsiders tend to be more impassioned, whether it be the Swedish Foreign Ministry or the U.S. Congress, tend to be more impassioned and less attuned to the subtleties, in part because they know less, and in part because they look at it in a cruder way. And they should be far more humble and listen far more to the participants than to have these grand ideas that they know better.
As we sort of wind up here and moving down the road of this dramatic day, Dr. Pipes, how could help us think through how Israel the day after, regardless of which party comes out ahead in the contest, how should we handle our relations with the United States? Should Israel be forthright? Mr. Netanyahu, many believe, would not come to Congress and address the joint session, but would actually back off at the last minute. And he did, clearly, we saw. Should Israel be a little bit more, some say, a little bit more modest in the face of the United States?
The U.S.'s relationship is a very large one. It has a religious component. It has a literal family component. It has a business component and many other aspects to it. The executive branch, as symbolized by the president, is only one part of that. To be sure, a very important part, but only one part. This is not like, say, U.S. relations with Saudi Arabia, which are very narrow, have to do with very few things and very few people. The U.S.'s relationship is very large and very wide. And therefore, I think, given the popularity of Israel in the United States and given the many dimensions of this relationship, the Israelis need not focus exclusively on the president. He is one actor among others, and he should not be allowed to dominate this relationship. Let me give you one quick example. A few years ago, when President Obama made this dramatic statement about how, at AIPAC, how Israel should return to the 67 borders, the very next day, in the very same podium, Harry Reid, who was arguably, or was arguably, the number two Democrat in Washington at that time, said, no, Israel shouldn't have to go back to the 67 borders. And that, to me, suggested that the president, even in his own party leadership, doesn't have control of this issue.
Right. It's much broader than the president. Daniel Pipes, Middle East Quarterly, Middle East Forum. Thank you so much for joining us. Enlightening and illuminating as always. Thank you so much.
And thank you for the invitation.
Dan Diker.
Very fascinating.
Yeah. Guy, I've been reading him since I've been reading.
A real authority, a real international authority on the Middle East.
Particularly on Islam. Article he just came with about Islam, I'd actually like to have him on a whole different show about that. But his perception, the only thing that can really be done to remedy the whole Islamic situation in the world is not secularization of Islam, but they have to be moderate to try to get them to be more moderate. I don't know if there's any way to really, inflict that and ask people to compromise on their religion. Like, is there a problem with Islam or not? But that's not the point. I digress. What do you have to say about what Daniel just shared?
Well, Daniel Pipes has always been a contrarian thinker on the Middle East. I remember when he received the Renner Prize for Jerusalem. It was called the Lion of Judah Prize, I believe it was called. That is a prize for outstanding scholars on the Middle East.
And when was that?
This was it was some years ago. I think it must have been, goodness gracious, 7 or 8 or 9 years ago.
Yeah, you know what? I was his bodyguard. I was his. I took him around. Him and Alan Keyes. Yes.
Oh, yeah. I think
that's when I met him. That's when I spent time with him.
So there you have it. So there you have it. And what I remember from his acceptance speech, because the people prepare, was his criticism of Israel, that Israel seemed not to embrace its own rights in Jerusalem as much as the Arabs around. And so the incitement and the vitriol by Arab Muslim states and the Palestinians were much louder. Because Israel should have been louder than they, and we were, and there is a really there is a real message you have to think about, and he really forces us to think about our assumptions, and he's such a deep expert on Islam and the Near East, and I think that on the issue of moderating. Moderating Islam, I think he takes not a dissimilar approach from Professor Bernard Lewis, who at the age of 98, almost 99, is the greatest living scholar on the Near East and Islam. And his view also, similar to Dr. Pipes, is that Islam is in a conversation with itself, it's in a battle with itself, and there are forces that are more moderate forces, and that they have to try to navigate an Islam that has never been navigated beyond... look at the radicalization of Islam. You don't have the reform and conservative as we do in Jewish streams. We have reform, we have conservative, we have modern Orthodox, we have traditionally what they call right-wing Orthodox. They don't have, they don't have the tradition arguing
right internal dissent. I mean, they do, but usually it ends with
your
heads off.
Exactly,
right, yeah.
Exactly. And I think that's the discussion. I mean, Bernard Lewis has brought this up all the time. This is the discussion and the fight and the tension that Islam is going to have to work out. I would suggest that the more liberal approaches to Islam come from thinkers in the United States. People there are Muslim thinkers that have. Sheikhs like Sheikh Kabbani, for example, who is a well-known liberal thinker on Islam, that the United States sometimes affords people the chance to think a little bit more outside the box. Having said that, the father of radical Islam, Said Qutb, spent time in the United States, and it had the opposite effect on him when he came back to the Middle East. And there are others, by the way, in the PLO and in the Hamas.
It's a fascinating phenomenon.
That many go to the United States and get doctorates there, and they come back, and they're even more,
radicalized.
That's a whole topic. That's a fascinating topic.
It really is. It really is. America, with all of its sort of liberal open-mindedness, has a way of radicalizing people. like no Islamic ISIS country can. I don't
know.
There you have it. Anyways, we're here at Dan Diker. We had Daniel Pipes with us. And today's election day. May whatever happens today be the best for Israel and the Jewish people. This is Ari Abramowitz, Israel Inspired on Voice of Israel.